heard your little speech about the cable TV wire, 75-ohm treasure that's found. Evidently has 500 meters of it, and his call sign is XE1GXG. Well, let's go. All right. He'd like to know if it's usable, and maybe you'd give him a little rundown on what you think the benefits of that cable are when it's free. And it is definitely usable, and I'm sure you can give him a lot of tips. So you pick that up for Roberto and see what you can tell him. EC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Now, the 75-ohm cable for cable TV that he's got, do you believe it is something like 3/4 inch or 7/8 inch hard line? Do you believe it's RG6U or RG59 with type F connectors on the end? I know it's a long length, but what kind of cable are we talking about here first? Do you believe, John? Over to you, John.
It's the larger size, you know, comparable to RG8, a little bit bigger. Nice stuff, hard line.
Okay, one of my favorite cables. And the signal you're listening to me on right now is going through a piece of 75-ohm hard line. I believe the piece I'm using right now is around 75 feet long. And so I've got a 50-ohm transmitter going into a 75-ohm piece of cable, going into a 50-ohm antenna. And what I've done to make sure that this all works correctly is I put a piece of paper tape alongside of the hard line cable. I wrote it on the hard line cable, stuck it to it, and wrote 50 ohms on it, and make sure that that piece of tape faces toward the transmitter and faces toward the receiver. Obviously, that's a joke. What I'm getting at is that if your transmitter was a perfect 50-ohm source, and if your antenna was a perfect 50-ohm load, and you use 75-ohm transmission line, that's a 1.5 standing wave ratio, worst case. And if you calculate what happens with a 1.5-to-1 standing wave ratio in your cable, I seem to remember it's something like 0.2 dB of calculated loss because of impedance mismatch. So in almost all circumstances, you take a piece of 75-ohm cable, make believe it's 50, you'll never see the difference. One of the reasons why cable TV companies use 75-ohm cable, let me drop it, is that if you look at a really good book, can't think of the author's name all of a sudden, Microwave Transmission Line Techniques, I think is the name of the book, can't think of the author's name, it's this very gyroscope engineer, 1948 or 1950, he wrote this paperback book, which has got a very interesting curve in there. He shows you all the properties of cables that are various impedances. It turns out that a 38-ohm piece of cable has the highest power handling capability. A 70-ohm piece of cable has the lowest insertion loss. A 120-ohm piece of coax cable has got the highest impedance when you use it as a resonator. And various impedances have various advantages. So highest power is 38 ohms. Lowest insertion loss is 75 ohms. 50 ohms is sort of a compromise between highest power and lowest insertion loss. That's one of the reasons why the United States chose 50 ohms as a standard. Much of Europe uses 70 ohms as a standard. The cable TV companies use 70 ohms as a standard or 75 ohms because of the lowest insertion loss. Let me drop. When you're stringing hundreds and thousands of miles cable across utility poles to make a cable TV system in a town, and you've got to put 10 or 14 amplifiers per mile to make up for the insertion loss along that length of cable. You can see that the insertion loss of the cable and dollars you've got to spend for amplifiers, there's a one-to-one relationship there. So for the reasons of the cable being lowest in loss at 75 ohms, they chose 75 as a standard. Now, for you to take that cable and by all kinds of Mickey Mouse techniques, find ways of attaching a connector on the end of the cable. Within reason, they all work. There are guys who have gone to a hardware store and they buy various plumbing fittings and with cable clamps and things like that. They find ways of adapting it to a UHF or a type end or whatever. the connector that goes on the end of the cable used by the cable company, which screws into the box, which is their amplifier. That connector is called a stinger. If you go to the cable company stockyard, they usually have a whole bunch of those used stinger connectors that they throw into a barrel and only use them if they're at the end of their supply, so to speak. They'd like to rather put on new connectors all the time. You get some of those used ones, take them apart, get rid of the metal chips, put some new silicon grease on the rubber seal in there, and install it on the end of your cable. And installing it on the end of the cable, you have to whittle away some of the foam in the cable. And if you want to do an exact job, you actually buy the reaming tool that does that. But with your Swiss Army knife, you can do a good enough job. And you install that connector on the end of the cable, it does a beautiful job of giving you a strong mechanical strength connector with good weatherproofing. Let me drop. And most of those stinger connectors have a thread on the outside which is 5/8 24, 5/8 of an inch diameter, 24 threads per inch. Most of the brand of type N male connectors that go on the end of the cable, a UG21 connector, most of them, the nut on the back end is also 5/8 24. So you remove the nut on the back end of your UG21 connector and screw it onto the stinger. Cut the stinger to the right length so you can solder on the center pin of the type N connector. And now you've made a mechanical adapter. And using one of the rubber O-rings in the right spot, you can even make that a reasonably weatherproof adaptation. So that's one way you can install a type N connector on the end of a piece of hardline cable. There's ways you can put on a UHF connector and so on. Don't worry about the insertion loss of connectors. It's almost always zero, as long as it'll pass an ohmmeter test, if you know what I mean. The connector itself and even your crazy mechanical adaptation, let me drop. Even your crazy mechanical adaptation is only going to be an inch or an inch and a quarter long. And at almost every frequency up to 432 megahertz, that's a 27th of a wavelength or a 1,000th of a wavelength. It doesn't matter. Even though the innards of your adapted connector is not going to be exactly 50 ohms, not going to be 70 ohms, don't worry about it. You can get away with murder with having the wrong impedance connector, the wrong impedance length of transmission line somewhere in the system, as long as it's a small fraction of a wavelength, or conversely, if it's an even number of half wavelengths, the impedance repeats. And so a mismatch is not a mismatch, if you know what I mean. Your biggest problem with using semi-rigid cable is that however you adapt connectors on the end, you'd like it to be well weatherproofed and mechanically strong enough to hang together. And it takes a little bit of getting used to hardline cable. You don't want to bend it too sharp and make kinks and so on. But hardline cable, with or without the outer black jacket on it, let me drop. That cable is so rugged. If you were running from the shack to a tower that's in the backyard 70 feet away, That cable, in most cases, is made for direct burial in the ground and 20 years of life expectancy or more. Very rugged stuff. So properly installed, it gives you the lowest possible loss, the best possible shielding. And the only place where it's not very compatible is if you're using hardline going up a crank-up tower. Life gets a bit complicated to live with the crank-up tower going up and down, with hard line cable being continuously being flexed. You don't want to bend it multiple times, you'll eventually develop metal fatigue. Unless you put a loop of it in just the right way. And when it comes to going around the rotator, you've got two choices there. You can make a watch spring rotating. You can make a couple of turns of hard line cable going around your rotator that acts like a watch spring. Or right at the rotator, you adapt back to a flexible key piece of cable like RG9. My favorite kind of cable to go around the rotator is RG9, which is RG214. It's double-shielded type RG8 light cable, polyethylene dielectric. I like that polyethylene dielectric on the rotatable piece because it keeps out the water. I do not like foam-filled cable on the rotator because foam-filled cable, if it is a flexible piece of foam-filled cable, water vapor always slowly walks through that outer black jacket, and eventually you get water inside the foam, and the insertion loss starts climbing real fast. So foam-filled cables, flexible foam fill cables. I am not in favor of them. There's one slight exception to that. Let me drop them.
Comment, K6DDM.
How recognized. There are a couple of brands of foam fill cable which have an outer foil rating, outer foil layer, which is a pretty good hermetic seal. It's not just wrapped foil. It's foil that's really sealed correctly. So there are some flexible foam filled cables with foil on the outside that are okay for outdoor use. But as a VHF ham radio operator, ordinary braided foam filled flexible cable, I think can always give you trouble downrange. Maybe there's some other brands that get around this problem. And what's your favorite way of putting connectors on the end of hardline cable, Al? K6DPZ, KQRIW, the TechNet.
KQRIW, the TechNet, K6DPZ. Now, I wanted to make a mention of something else. You know, most of the hardline in 75, you know, from the TV field and everything else and all that. Many years ago, in our communications company in California, we had the large antenna systems up on Mount Wilson. I had access to all the hardline I wanted, 75 ohms. But the antennas I were using were DP products, Motorola, you know, base station antennas. And they were all on a fixed type frequencies we were using. I made line sections for the 75 ohm hardline. And I had those puppies matching one to one. And the feed lines didn't cost me a cent. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, if you're a real exacting guy, you're doing moon bounce, and you want the last fraction of a dB of performance out of your system, and you're using 70-ohm cable because it's the most reliable, lowest insertion loss stuff you can get your hands on, and you want to get a perfect impedance match between the 75-ohm cable and the 50-ohm antenna and the 50-ohm transmitter, to build a quarter-wave matching transformer on each end of 62 ohms, so a quarter wavelength of cable at 62 ohms, will give you a nearly perfect impedance match between 50-ohm cable, a 50-ohm antenna, and 75-ohm cable. And to make a piece of 62-ohm, there may be a couple of brands of cable that are 62-ohm, but you can homebrew it with pieces of copper tubing. Take whatever diameter copper tubing or square tubing that you like as the outer conductor, where you can easily install your UG58 wall-mounted type-end connectors on them, and then by choosing the right diameter of the center conductor, you will get a 62-ohm piece of coax. And the right diameter of center conductor you can get from the K&E brass company. You go to any good hobby shop where they sell you brass tubing to be used for the fuel lines to the tanks of your aircraft engine. You buy the right diameter of brass tubing and put it inside of your quarter wavelength piece of homebrew hardline, if you know what I mean. And now you'll get a 63-ohm impedance, and you'll get a perfect impedance match. So there are various ways of doing it. You can also do it with a stump tuner. Let me drop it. A little bit hard to believe, but if you go back the right number of wavelengths from one end of the cable, you put a right angle, you put a T-connector, and then you put in either short circuit or open circuit stub of just the right length, which is going to act like an inductor or a capacitor. And because you've made that out of coax cable, it's probably kilowatt rated, if you know what I mean. So if you choose the correct position along the length of transmission line and build a short or an open circuit stub of just the right length, that will give you a perfect impedance match at that end, and you do the same thing on the other end. So there's multiple ways of getting a perfect impedance match between 75-ohm cable and 50-ohm signal generator and 50-ohm antenna. Multiple ways of doing it. Back to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. Good stuff, Hardline. I like it.
Absolutely, Dick. Very useful. And he's got a great length of 500 meters. Fun. And by the way, Roberto sent his thanks and said great information, so I guess he's going to put it to use. Let me let it drop and I'll go on to the next question, because we've got to get to Paul. Okay, this comes from a young gentleman here who has a couple of 11-meter receivers. One of them is a Pierce Simpson, and the squelch control is not working. Although the other 11-meter receiver he has a squelch control that works fine. They're different brands, and he doesn't know how to troubleshoot. What should he start doing? He doesn't have a diagram available, and Pierce Simpson is an old outfit from the 60s, so it may not be available. Maybe you can give him some tips on what to look for. It's AM, and it covers from 20 megahertz to 30 megahertz.
This is ETC with a comment.
Go ahead, Al.
Okay, I saw that radio from years back. First thing you should do is just take, disconnect the squelch control and take a DC resistance measurement to that control. Chances are the control is open, and that's why he's not able to have a squelch action there.
Hal, do you have an approximate value on that?
John, you know, it's been a long time. If he just puts a meter on the center of the pot, swings the pot to each side, and see if the pot has continuity, chances are it's open on one side.
Okay, yeah, that sounds good. Back to you, Dick.
On quite a few rigs, the squelch control and the volume control are two concentric controls on the exact same hole through the front panel, so to speak. And that method of failure of the squelch potentiometer is a very common failure on the Kenwood 751A 2-meter all-mode mobile transceiver, one of my favorite rigs. It's a very nice tunable IF rig for UHF and microwave work. Kenwood 751, 2-meter all-mode, goes from 144 to 148. That's even before you make any modifications to it. But that roughly 10K potentiometer for squelch quite often becomes an open circuit, and therefore you lose squelch function. And it's a relatively rare potentiometer. To do an exact replacement is a bit of a pain. But testing that potentiometer with an ohmmeter is the quickest way of finding out 80 or 90% of the time what the failure of squelch is. And if something else has failed in the squelch, I'm going to give you a couple of words on how the squelch works, therefore with an oscilloscope and an audio amplifier. There's ways you can do some probing in the circuit to find out why the squelch is not working. If you find that the pot is working correctly, and you have to go one step deeper, I'll tell you what squelch does. Let me drop. If you were putting a signal generator into almost any kind of receiver, AM receiver or FM receiver, and when your signal generator is turned down to a nearly zero signal output, and the audio gain control in the receiver is set normally, and squelch is not working, you'll hear a fair amount of rushing noise coming out of the loudspeaker. And as you start turning up the signal generator, the noise coming out of the loudspeaker gets quieter and quieter. So you notice that a receiver gets quiet when it's got real signal going into it. Whether it be AM or FM, both do that. Also, if you had an audio spectrum analyzer on the receiver, you'll notice something else funny, particularly with an FM receiver. That is, as the signal gets weak, the first noise that starts coming through the loudspeaker is high frequency noise. In other words, the noise around 10 kilohertz, the high frequency hiss, comes up faster than the low frequency rumble as the signal gets weaker. The way most squelch circuits work is they look for the high frequency noise, and now they do an inverse function. They measure the amount of high frequency noise coming out of the detector circuit, the audio detector circuit, and if the high frequency noise is above some particular number, it does the equivalent of closing a relay that stops the audio from coming out of the loudspeaker. We call that squelch. And once the receiver gets quiet enough on 10 KC noise, it says, okay, the signal is strong enough, there's probably some good audio there, it enables the audio circuit. So that's the way squelch on many receivers works, and so those are the two things to look for. Potentiometer first, and after that to find out why the circuit looking for 10 KC audio is or is not detecting that audio and flipping that relay, so to speak. I call it a relay. In many cases, it's a solid state. It's a transistor acting as an on-off relay. But repeater,
time out.
Okay, it looks like we got the Eastern repeater still working, so we're still in operation. So Once you know the theory of operation, it gives you a little bit more of a hint to know what to look for. KC2 WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
It's DTZ with a comment.
You got it, Hal.
RIW KC2DTZ. You're talking about an FM type of squelch circuit where you have a noise amplifier, a noise rectifier, and then you have a gate on the audio output stage. On the CB set, it's not that type of thing, Dick. What they're doing is taking ATC voltage that drives the IF and RF stages, and they pick off one of the IF screen grids, and when there's a change in ATC, this automatically, you lock up the audio, changes the bias, and opens up the audio circuit. No noise amplifier, no absence of noise. An AM unit works on AGC chain. Signal comes in, AGC goes up, the screen grid on the IF drops, the voltage changes, and that opens up the receiver's audio. Go ahead. AM, not FM.
Yeah, I should have remembered that one, Hal. Glad you brought that to our attention. Now, because his audio gain control, because his automatic volume control voltage is not climbing, that has failed, or one of the other stages. You have to have a certain amount of gain between the front end of the receiver and the final detector in order to develop that AVC voltage. So if one of my tubes was real weak or dead in the amplifier chain between the antenna and the detector downrange, if I lost one of those tubes, I wouldn't develop enough gain in order to develop an AVC voltage, automatic vein voltage control. The way the ABC works is that as the signal coming into the front end gets stronger and stronger, your rectifier downrange develops a bigger and bigger negative voltage. Usually it shoves that negative voltage back into some of the earlier stages of the RF amplifier or IF stage on one of the control grids. It starts putting negative voltage, which cuts back the gain to make sure you don't overload. The whole purpose of automatic volume control, let me drop this.
Another comment after you drop.
The whole purpose of automatic volume control is to stop the condition that used to happen before, I think it was Harold Wheeler working for Sperry, working for the Hazeltine company, claims to be the inventor of automatic volume control, had the patent on it way back in the 20s. In the early days, you tune across your AM band, and if you ran into a strong radio station that was nearby, you got a blast out of the loudspeaker that would shake the room. And then you go to the next station that's weak, you get very little. So automatic volume control was needed. And by rectifying the RF voltage coming out of the IF voltage out of the last stage and feeding it back as a negative voltage, controls the gain of the system, and therefore essentially all radio signals you tune to will have the same volume. That's the main purpose of automatic volume control. On many of the tube older rigs, it was a negative voltage. The bigger the negative voltage, the stronger the signal that was coming in. So the squelch circuit in that case would look for, it would have a threshold detector. What would you call that now? I forget what they call that thing. But a threshold detector that when the voltage is above a certain number, it enables the audio, knowing if the signal is strong enough. K6DPZ, K2RIW.
Okay, we're working on many AM sets for many years in CB as well as commercial. If there is a problem, what happens many times, an older radio has bypass capacitors on the ATC, on the ABC bus. That's a detected negative signal coming from the detector, which goes back to the other stages to lower the gain. Being it's a high impedance bus going through 1 megaohm resistors or higher to go to the different grids of the different tubes, a lot of the bypass...
Yeah, house signal got suddenly chopped off, but he's bringing up another very good point, and that is the highest impedance of voltage anywhere in a tube-type receiver, and even some solid-state receivers, is the ABC voltage. That voltage has an impedance of 1 megaohm, or in some cases closer to 10 megaohms. Tube-type receiver, to see if it's the proper number, you got to do it with a vacuum tube voltmeter or a modern-day digital voltmeter, both of which have a 10 megaohm input impedance. If you take your ratty old triplet or a Simpson 630, you take an ordinary volt ohm milliamp meter, which has got a much, much lower impedance, and you try to measure AGC voltage. Because that voltage has got such a high impedance, your meter will kill the voltage, so to speak, and you get a phony reading. Any bypass capacitor that's on the ABC line better have a leakage of 10 megohms or above at the operating voltage. So if that bypass capacitor, which in some cases is a 0.1 microfarad or 0.01 microfarad, if it develops a leakage of, let me pick a number, 500 kiloohms, which under normal circumstances is not bad, if that's the capacitor across an ABC line, it can really kill the ABC voltage. Let's see if Hal's got some further comments on this. K6DBZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, are you copying me okay?
Now I am, but you had a sudden dropout in the middle of your last transmission. We waited 10 seconds and you didn't come back.
Accidentally, the power cord pulled out of the back of the 17. It was running on battery. So, well, question, are you hearing us okay with no hum or anything?
You sound beautiful. Please proceed.
As I mentioned, the AGC bus is high impedance, and anything that would load it down would be a problem. An easy way to check if something is loading down the AGC bus, take a digital voltmeter, which is high impedance, even make it a little more high impedance, put a 4.7 megohm resistor in series with a DC probe, and then measure your voltage on the AGC, especially if you tune in a signal, it's a constant signal, broadcast station, or just a constant signal, so you have a constant AGC voltage. High value resistors to drive each grid. If you see a radical drive in voltage from one point to the other, that means one of the caps on the AGC line is loading it down. K2RIW, K6DBZ.
So a capacitor can load it down. In some cases, they've got megohm resistors that are doing dividing. They can sometimes becoming flaky. Once in a blue moon, one of the vacuum tubes can become extremely gassy, in which case the leakage of the control grid acts as another resistor, killing AGC voltage. That's a more rare one, but I did run into that one time. But once you know what the AGC voltage is supposed to look like, what it's supposed to do, and you know it's an extremely high impedance voltage, that is to say, it can't tolerate very much loading. Most digital voltmeters start off these days with a 10 megohm input impedance, regardless of what voltage range you're on. So usually they don't create significant loading of an AGC line. But a triplet or a Simpson volt ohm milliamp meter really cannot be used to measure AGC voltage because at 20,000 ohms per volt, it creates a whole lot of loading. KC2 WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
One more comment on that.
Yeah, go ahead, Hal.
Have a 10 megohm resistor with a Simpson 260 or any other, you know, VOM is 20,000 ohms per volt, and you have a relative reading of voltage on the meter. You can go to the lowest voltage scale and it will not load down the circuit.
That's a good point. As long as you own a 10 megohm resistor, that's a bit of a rare value. Not many guys have got one. But a 10 megohm resistor into a volt ohm milliamp meter on the lowest scale, and your lowest scale may be 3 volts full scale. At 20,000 ohms per volt, that means it's acting like a 60,000 ohm load. The volt ohm milliamp meter is 60,000 ohms. And you're putting a 10 megohm resistor in series with it before doing the voltage measurement, and now you're not loading down the AGC voltage, but now you've got to do some mathematics. You've got a voltage divider network. Your meter is 60,000 ohms. It's going through a 10 megohm resistor, and therefore you can calculate what ratio. And maybe 3/10 of a volt really is 3 volts, if you know what I mean, when you figure out the ratio. But at least it's a calibrated way of doing things. KC2 WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
More comment, Dick, then I definitely have to run.
Go ahead, Hal.
Same way, if you're working with a transmitter and you want to be able to measure the grid bias voltage on the transmitting tubes, take a 2.5 millihenry RF choke, put it in series with the probe on a VOM, and you're not going to detune the circuit. You can measure the negative voltage going to the grid to see if you have the proper voltage. You're not going to have an IR drop through the choke that much. But
Yeah, in that particular case, as long as the resistor is the right kind of a resistor, you could use the 10 mega ohm resistor or the RF choke, and you'll have to use some interpretation, so to speak, as to the voltage drop. But the 10 mega ohm resistor also is a kind of RF choke at usual frequencies, usual kind of a 10 mega ohm resistor. I like the RF choke, of course, a lot better. And on many rigs, the amount of drive going to a control grid of a transmitting tube causes it to develop a negative voltage on the control grid. The drive causes it to rectify a negative voltage. And so on some transmitters, the negative voltage on the control grid being too low a number represents one of two failures. Either there's not enough drive going to that grid, not enough RF voltage is getting there, or the tube itself has got gas inside and it's not becoming leaky. In either case, that measurement and the error in that measurement is giving you information telling you something more about the troubleshooting you're doing of that particular transmitter. KC2WGB, K2RIW, the TechNet.
KC2WGB. All right, very good information, and it's very important when working with volts to realize on your low resistance readings and low, when you get down at 20,000 ohms per volt, that meter can really load a lot of circuits, so that's more good information. And that's a great tip with that RF choke and probe on the grids of those transmitters. Yeah, that's an excellent idea. Okay, Dick, I think we should go over to Paul. It's 20 to 11, and let's see what he's got for us. KC2WGB. It's in from the mailbag. Back to you, Dick.
LU8 Joe recognized. Before we go over to Joe, one thing I want to indicate, though, is that when you're using an RF choke into a meter or a 10 mega ohm resistor into a meter, and if you know what you're doing, it can really stop you from loading the circuit. It can allow you to make measurements where you're not disturbing the circuit you're trying to measure. And although not many people know it, your oscilloscope probe also is a significant load. Many oscilloscopes will have 7.5 picofarad. I'm talking about a times 10 oscilloscope probe. Will have something like 7.5 picofarad of capacitance and a loading of a couple of thousand ohms, as I remember. And so putting an oscilloscope probe into a sensitive RF circuit of a receiver or a transmitter can detune the circuit. And if you're smart enough to put an RF choke in series with a small RF choke in series with the oscilloscope probe, or the right kind of a series resistor in series with the oscilloscope probe, that can allow you to make measurements on the screen. You'll have to do some calibrating because the times 10 probe, let me drop the times 10 probe won't be times 10 anymore. Maybe it's going to be times 100, but still, with proper calibration, you can now figure out what you're doing, and you can stop the oscilloscope probe from loading down the sensitive circuit. Where I really ran into this problem is that I brought home a precision frequency meter that went out to 12 decimal places, and I had the intention of measuring the oscillator that's inside of the clock circuit of my watch. I wanted my watch to have an accuracy of 1 second per day or 1 second per week, and I thought if I set the oscillator in there to the exact frequency, I would get that. Oh boy, did I have a surprise. No matter what I used for a probe, no matter how I decoupled the probe, touching the probe onto the oscillator circuit of a modern-day watch, solid-state watch, with a quartz crystal inside, loads down the circuit something fierce. That quartz crystal in there is the highest impedance circuit in the world. You put 0.001 picofarad onto that oscillator by way of a highly decoupled oscilloscope probe, and you're changing the oscillator frequency, and you think you're going to set it to some very exact number because you're using a frequency counter that's got 12 decimal places. You've got 12 decimal places of resolution you have, or an accuracy there of about 4 decimal places because you're loading the circuit. That circuit inside of a quartz watch is so extremely sensitive. The only way in the world that you can measure that oscillator and get it on the right frequency is to look at whether or not your clock is, your watch is gaining 10 seconds per day or losing 10 seconds per day. And if you've got a little variable capacitor inside there, and some of them in the old days used to have, let me drop. and you turn that capacitor 2 degrees clockwise, and then find out what happens in the next 24 hours with your watch compared to WWV, and eventually you can get it where you want. As I remember, I got my Omicron watch down to something like a couple of seconds per week, if and only if I wore the watch 24 hours a day. If I took the watch off and laid it on the counter overnight, the watch would cool off and run at a slightly different frequency. But that's the most sensitive circuit in the world, the main oscillator circuit inside of a quartz watch. And there's almost no way you can put a probe in there to set the frequency accurately. There probably is a way where you could have an extremely loosely coupled antenna-like device where you listen to the third harmonic of the oscillator into a very sensitive receiver and then compare that against WWV. There's probably a way that you could set the oscillator directly without loading it down. But if you did it on the fundamental with any kind of a receiver, if you did it with any kind of a scope probe that's within reason, the loading of your circuit is going to be create more inaccuracy than you're looking for. W2LYY, K2L.
Quick comment, first stick.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
I just wanted to point out to everybody, oscilloscope probes, the ones that are, say, 200 megahertz and they have a switch, times 1, times 10, do not have the frequency response in the times 1 position that you have in the times 10 position. And that is due to the fact that if you put it in the times 1 position, you're going to think you put a ohm meter from the tip to the input of the BNC connector, it's going to be 0 ohms. It isn't. If you check the good probes, you'll see they're anywhere between 200 and 350 ohms. Isn't that weird?
And that's the resistive loading. And then after that resistor that's right at the tip of the scope probe, you're then driving a certain length of what looks like 90-ohm coaxial cable into the BNC connector under the front panel of the oscilloscope, and then the input circuitry of the oscilloscope. You've got significant loading. In the times one position, if you're measuring a really brute force audio circuit that doesn't have super high frequency to it, the times one position can give you great sensitivity. But if you're measuring hundreds of megacycles, I think you almost cannot use the times one probe, and even the times 10 function is still giving you very light loading in many situations, but not zero loading. I think most of them are 7.5 picofarad and some number of kiloohms of loading, unless you put some other device in series with the probe before you connect it to your delicate circuit. There are ways of doing super high frequency measurements with an oscilloscope, but it takes some trickery, if you know what I mean. All right, let's see what Joe's got to say. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
2CPC with a comment.
Okay, right after me. First of all, I tried checking early about my transmitter. I must have had a function with it, because I pushed the button, the light lit up, and my voice didn't come out of the repeater. So you can put me on a list for next week for a question, top of the list. And I have a comment about you setting a clock in your apparatus. Would you like to hear my comment on that, Dick?
Yeah, let's pick up Hal, and then we're going to go to you and answer your question right now, Joe. K60BZ with a comment. K2RIW, go ahead, Hal.
K2RIW, K60BZ. I want to correct you on one thing, Dick. You mentioned putting a small soak in series with the scope probe to measure RF circuit, to measure a signal that you don't want to disrupt. Problem with that is, if you use a little choke, that its self-inductance, the capacitance, becomes resonant near the frequency that you want to measure, your scope will never measure an accurate level. Because the little LC circuit there, and that choke will suck out the energy.
You bring up a good point. When I put chokes and resistors in series of the scope probe, in order to lighten the loading of the circuit, in that case, I may be looking for a particular waveform. Maybe it's a pulse signal. I want to know what is the pulse duration and pulse rep rate and things like that and rise time. However, when it comes to making a calibrated voltage measurement where you've added extra doodads to a scope probe, now you've got to be really careful. To get it back into calibration or to make a measurement that the X number of centimeters of deflection on the oscilloscope screen represents some number of millivolts or microvolts. That could be kind of difficult. So you've got a conflict of interest here of getting accuracy and light loading with scope probes. But a smart guy can get around that. And in some oscilloscopes, there is a square wave internal generator that when you go to the very fast sweep speeds, the square wave goes up to megacycle rates, maybe even tens of megacycle rates. So there are ways with your modified scope probe where you get back to almost calibrating it. But yes, you got to be careful with this one. The accuracy of measurement goes out the window. The frequency response goes out the window. But if you're looking for timing information and you don't want to load the circuit, there's ways you can do it. Now, Joe, what do you think is required to accurately set the clock inside of a quartz watch? W2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
My answer, a very accurate signal source. My comment is going to be this. I had a controller, an ACC controller, that had a clock inside that ran the clock. And I think initially it was like 732-768 kilohertz. I was able to use a receiver, sensitive receiver, and go to about 400 times that frequency, listen to that frequency, and beat it with an accurate signal generator. And I got the thing so it would hold about maybe 4 or 5 seconds per month. How's that for accuracy, Dick?
Yeah, that's quite good. With the technique I used, I was able to get roughly a second per week, which I guess was around 4 or 5 seconds per month also. And so it's doable. These quartz crystals inside of a modern-day solid-state watch are pretty good. They got a rather high Q. Don't know the exact number. If somebody told me it had a Q of 50,000, I would almost believe it. Over to you, Joe, K2RIW.
I'm going to comment when I have a chance.
Yeah, the thing you have to be careful of is when you open the item up to make the adjustment, you have to monitor the frequency before you do that. And then you open the thing, if you can get close enough to be able to sniff the frequency, that's some sort of multiple of it, accurately. Because you'll find as you open up the thing and the cool air rushes into that crystal, it'll change the frequency. So you have to know how much drift you just inserted into your equation before you start turning the screws.
And just opening up the case changes the capacitance the oscillator sees. Go ahead to Hal.
I set a lot of clocks on different types of pieces of equipment, clock crystals, and what I'll do is take a scope probe, put it right on the case of the crystal. That way you're not loading it, but enough gain, I tap off my vertical output amplifier of the scope into a counter, and I can set the frequency of a clock very easily. It will not disrupt the characteristics of the oscillator that the clock crystal is looking into. Just go right on the cam.
Yeah, that's a good technique. There's probably a way by which you could create a very small sniffer coil and keep the sniffer coil as far away from the oscillator as possible, but still get a signal above threshold on your oscilloscope, counter, or whatever. So, to make a measurement of a very precise oscillator without violating the Heisenberg uncertainty principle basically says that whenever you're doing something very delicate, like measuring the motion of an electron, your method of measurement is going to disturb the thing that you're trying to measure. And so getting high accuracy without disturbance is a conflict, a very serious conflict. There are ways around it, and Hal and I are giving you some hints. I think you had another question, Joe, or another comment you want to make. B2RYY, K2RIW.
It's too late in the tech that you want to go over to Paul, because Paul's standing by. As I asked and I requested, I'd like to be put on the list for the next week at the beginning of the list. And I'll make sure I'm there and listening, because it seemed like a few times it's happened that I pushed the button, and I don't seem to get through at the beginning of the tech net, so I just will go back in listening mode. So I'll have a good one for next week, and it has to do with exactly what you talked about measuring and measurement accuracy.
Very fine, Joe. Okay, you're on the list for next week. In case I forget, all these witnesses listening, W2RYY goes to the head of the list next week. Alrighty. Should we go to another mailbag, or question number one, John. And so also, when you're monitoring the IRLP or Echolink, were you getting a fair number of people checking in tonight, and were any of them expressing questions? Roberto apparently was talking to you while we were giving him an answer. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Yeah, we had 11 people on Echolink. Well, 10, not counting me. And Roberto was active. And I'm also monitoring the chat room. I don't monitor IRLP. I don't have that set up here yet, Dick. But, yeah, it was very active tonight. We average about 10 a week that are on here most of the time. And maybe three or four of them are different people.
Of the 10 or so that are on Echolink, one of them obviously was Roberto in Mexico. I am guessing one or two of them are in Canada. Where are the others coming from, John? Typically, go ahead.
Roberto's the only one that's out of the country. The rest, I don't have any Canadians on there. I'm looking at it right now, but mostly locals.
And in the past, what's the greatest DX you've ever seen on a Echolink sign-in, John? Go ahead.
Philippines, believe it or not.
That is DX. And how in the world did a guy in the Philippines find out about the TechNet? Starts at 8 o'clock our time, which is very close probably to 8 o'clock in the morning his time. And 8 o'clock in the morning for him on Monday morning on a work day. And he's listening to the TechNet. Interesting. Okay, Paul, what's NASA doing? And tell me once again, as if you normally don't, how many astronomical units is Voyage number one away from us tonight? WS2N, K2RIW, you got it, Paul.
Hi, Dick, John, Hal, this is WS2N. Oh, yeah, you got, you're up to what, 120? And the other one is 106 or something. Went up one, I think, last week, which used to be 105, so that one went up to 106. It just keeps on going, and I know you're right about the 17, I think it's 17 and a half hours one way. Speed of light, so interesting. Always interesting to follow the Voyager missions, and they're not over yet. I wanted to bring up the, since the New Year is ticking over, we're getting a year closer to the launch of the James Webb Space Telescope. So it's been the year is going to be 2018. Originally, when they thought about this thing about 1993 or so, 1994, they were hoping for a 2013-14 launch. But early on, they had a lot of delays, almost cancellations because of funding. The cost was going up too high. And it wound up some years ago at 2018 and stabilized there. So it should be interesting to see what happens. I wanted to bring that up because there's a very good YouTube explanation of how this space telescope is going to unfurl. I know I've seen some in the past, and ones in the past make it look like it gets out to its L2 position, you know, four times the distance of the sun, roughly, you know, almost a million miles out. I think it's 900.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And everything opens up, and then, you know, you hope for the best. Let me drop it. They're very well done. The graphics are very good and all. But I have a new one that NASA came up with, which is more accurate. Now, when they launch James Webb, it's going to be launched from French Guiana on an Ariane 5 rocket launched by the European Space Agency. That's one of their contributions to the mission. It will take about 30 days, roughly a month, to get to its halo orbit, which is out at L2, roughly a million miles out. but they show the process of this thing self-assembling, you know, from the beginning, right at the launch. Very good graphics, showing the step-by-step, you know, the antenna coming out, the solar panels coming out, and when they do come out. So soon after launch, you know, an hour or two after launch, things start to happen. And then as the days go by, you know, a day will go by, and they'll bring out the sun shield, you know, one part of the sun shield. Another day will go by, and the other part will come out. Another day will go by, the radiators will come out for heat dissipation. And it'll go roughly through 15 or 16 days of this process of the antenna being raised from its present location. You know, it rises up, the pedals open up, these, 100-pound, or I think they were roughly 30-pound each, the hexagonal pedals, 18 of them, and how they unfurl. And, roughly after about 16 days, the whole thing is complete, and then goes through another course maneuver and goes into its halo orbit, you know, after a whole month. But it's very well done. This thing is the size of a tennis court when it's opened up, and it's worth viewing. So it was a long URL, so I shortened it. I made a tiny URL out of it, so you can view this thing by going to I made it tinyurl.com/NK9RV5. So it's tinyurl.com/November Kilo 9 Romeo Tango Bravo 5. It's worth a look. It goes roughly about a minute and a half or 2 minutes, no more than that. So it's not too long. No audio, no music, but just terrific graphics. Now let me drop it.
Once again, is that at the end, November Kilo 9, Romeo Tango 5, over to you.
I know, Dick. tinyurl.com/November Kilo 9 Romeo Tango Bravo 5. QSL?
Roger, Dodger. So the end of it is Romeo Tango Bravo 5. Okay, so that's what, about a 20-minute YouTube video showing it deployed. And as I see it, James Webb, with that great big parabolic gold-plated reflector, gold-plated so that it reflects infrared energy. That's going to be the largest space telescope ever in pure area. And infrared is going to allow it to have penetration of dust, and we're going to see things we've never seen before. To your knowledge, is that final detector at the focal point, is that cryogenically cooled with liquid helium? And if so, when that liquid helium runs out, I'm guessing they'll just be aiming a device of some kind toward cold space, and it'll settle for the 3 degrees Kelvin of cold space as a heat sink. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
And it also can do visible. So, and I guess they have to maybe run out of cryogenics. You know, they'll be able to use the telescope for probably years to come. You know, even without the cryogenic to keep the keep it cool. You know, in the future, there's a possibility, and NASA thought about this, that you could have, you know, maybe a refueling mission go robotic, or even a manned mission going to this telescope. Right now, it's out of the question. And it's not even planned on ever servicing the telescope. But just in case, for instance, SpaceX, for instance, with their heavy Falcon 9 heavy rocket system, they might employ them, or you know, or even send an Orion spacecraft out there, or a robotic spacecraft, to do some kind of work on this telescope in the future. And the possibility is there, and it was inexpensive to do. So they did put a docking ring on the bottom of this thing. So, just like they decided not to put a docking ring on the Hubble Space Telescope when that was launched in 1990. The final mission, I guess 5 years ago now, the shuttle crew went up there and refurbished the Hubble. One of the things that they did is they put a docking ring.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Dock with it and have a control burn reentry, but you never know. Maybe somebody might, if the Hubble is still stable, then they might decide on somehow. Highly unlikely, of course. Don't forget the Hubble had a real good work pad. You know, you had a whole shuttle bay to dock the Hubble and have crews out there working. Although it's possible you could have some kind of habitat module, module that could be attached to an Orion spacecraft or even a Dragon spacecraft and do that. The possibility is there. But like I said, right now, no plans on servicing the Hubble. And no plans on servicing James Webb. But the thought is in the back of their minds. So let's put a docking ring there. That's what they did. Let me drop it. How in the world you'd have to have enough fuel to bring a crew back? That sounds like a tough order. You never know. Send a fuel rocket out there all by itself sitting there. You get out there, you dock with it, and use that to come back. You never know. Wanted to mention a flight that went up last week. We always have competition, and the Russians are still at it. They have launched the Angara rocket. They've been working on the Angara rocket for probably almost 20 years. Angara will be a family of rockets which will eventually replace the Proton rocket, maybe even the Soyuz rocket. It will launch rockets to geosynchronous orbits, which this one did. It's a heavy lift vehicle. Essentially, it's taken five Angara rockets, putting them together, putting one in the center and four boosters, and they launched from Pleisk. They didn't launch from Baikonur, Kazakhstan. They actually launched from Russia, around 500 miles north of Moscow. And their idea is to get away from the Kazakhstan. You know, it's not the Soviet Union anymore, and they don't want to pay them. Do what they can do, by themselves. So that was a successful launch. put an operating satellite into orbit. They put a mass simulated satellite, weighing the same as if it was one. And they even had a breeze booster attached to it, because after they knew it was successfully put into geosynchronous orbit, that third stage pushed it into a graveyard orbit, never to be seen or heard from again. Let me drop it. And that's pretty much it. I mean, they've got the RT-191 rockets attached to it. They're fairly new design by the Russians. In fact, it's a very similar design that Orbital Science is going to be using and buying from the Russians. They call the RD-181. and they're going to be using them for the Antares rocket that they launch up to the International Space Station. That will replace the other Russian rocket,